Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to be here and talk about stuff which hopefully not all of you have seen everything that I'm going to say. Some of it is a bit old, but some of it's a little bit more recent. Okay, so yeah, I'm going to talk about ultra-relativistic collisions and black hole formation. Here's a rough outline of the talk, so I'll start with a bit of a motivation. I'd say there's sort of two main reasons why I'm interested in this. One is as a probe to theoretically understand the dynamical, nonlinear, strong field regime of general relativity. I would say this is perhaps my current motivation, but the one that I'm perhaps most interested in. But what sort of got me started in this area several years ago was the notion that that the LHC could be a black hole factory if the Planck scale is a lot lower than what we think. So the connections between this regime of relativity and Planck scale physics is also quite interesting. I think these days, that's perhaps there's less of a naturalness argument for that, and there's no evidence that black holes are being produced at the LHC, but it's still an interesting question, at least theoretically from a general relativistic perspective, why we can make these claims in spite of not having a theory of quantum gravity, which you think you might need for to make claims about super Planck scale collisions. Also, since this is sort of the 100th anniversary of GR, we've gone through the 100th anniversary. It's been 100 years since Einstein published his theory, and it's been 100 years since Schwarzschild published his black hole solution. We've had solutions that describe the strong field for a long time now. So also like just sort of motivated in context of this anniversary we've just had, sort of explaining sort of what we know about the strong field, what we don't know, what some of the big open questions are, in particular, does a strong field really exist in the universe? Is this something where what we think happens in theory actually happens out there in the universe? And then I want to describe some results from collisions of solitons, so models of particles. This is all purely classical relativity. I'm going to say a little bit about the quantum stuff every now and then, but this is all within classical relativity. So we're going to be modeling particles as basically self-gravitating stars, either boson stars or fluid stars, sort of describe what happens when they collide at ultra-relativistic velocities, and try to explain it in terms of essentially just geodesic focusing and Kirchhoff tube conjecture. So there's some interesting things in this ultra-relativistic limit where it seems as if at least the first order description of the physics is actually very, very simple. So if you think, you know, this is the most nonlinear regime of the field equations, things should be as far from simple descriptions as possible. But at least it seems that in this case, in the ultra-relativistic regime, certain aspects of the problem significantly simplify, and I'll try to describe that. It's not going to be a very precise description, but I think it's in some sense somewhat consistent with the results that I'll show you, and that's really going to sort of then in some sense creating all of these open questions with, well, can we make some of these statements that I'll say more precise, and are there connections with this ultra-relativistic regime? And some old problems in classical relativity about, you know, plane-planted gravitational wave collisions, the genericity of singularity formation, cosmic censorship, etc. So I'll sort of try to conclude with some open questions for future research. Okay, so this is my sort of very personal reflection on the history of the strong field in GR. It's not supposed to be necessarily, it's definitely not, it's missing out a lot of things, but just to sort of provide very rough flavor of what's been going on in the last 100 years. So of course, as I mentioned, we actually are celebrating 100 years of the discovery of the strong field regime with Schwarzschild publishing the solution for the Schwarzschild black hole. And actually, it was published in 1916, but he discovered it within a few months of Einstein publishing the field equation. So he actually discovered it in 1915. So it really is 100 years that we've known about the strong field. Cosmological solutions also exist in the strong field, and they were discovered in the next few years by Lemaître, de Sitter, Friedman, etc. So several people knew about the cosmological aspects. So despite the fact that they were essentially immediately known, for a long time after that, they were really either misinterpreted, misunderstood, or just dismissed as completely irrelevant to physics or to nature, especially with black hole solutions. And part of it's understandable, because at the time, if you were to take certain aspects of the Schwarzschild metric at face value and ask, well, where are the problems? Where are the things that are troubling to try to understand? You know, the event horizon, the singularity inside the event horizon. For ordinary objects that we're familiar with, planets, stars, at least in what they knew of at the time, there wasn't any object in the universe that was even close to being as compact as necessary for the inner parts of the Schwarzschild geometry to describe that. But in any case, for whatever reason, it was sort of in the backwaters of the field for a long time. But then there was a renaissance in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, sometimes called the golden age of general relativity or black hole physics. And there were sort of two things that simultaneously happened that created this renaissance. One was on the theoretical side. People actually started to really understand what black hole solutions were. From Penrose, Hawking, Israel, Kip Thorne, John Wheeler, many other people. And so to what was, the Schwarzschild solution is incredibly simple. You can write it down on one line. But what it implies is rather astonishing and bizarre deviations from general relativity as you approach the horizon. It's not just a little correction like some of the other things that had been discovered before, the deflection of light, the pericentric precession of Mercury, etc. So in this time, they started to understand black holes and how rich black holes are in theory. I think if that was all that it was, okay, it would have been an interesting, perhaps, science aspect of mathematical physics, but where what really made it sort of profound was that astronomers started discovering objects in the universe that perhaps we didn't know were black holes, but were consistent with being black holes. For example, quasars, which we now think are active galactic nuclei, so supermassive black holes accreting matter. The accretion is producing very bright luminosities. And the so-called X-ray binaries, which we now think are a star in orbit with a stellar mass black hole. Pulsars, so neutron stars, so objects which are very, very close to the compaction relevant for the Schwarzschild solution, the strong field aspects of the Schwarzschild solution and the cosmic microwave background. So this combination of theory and observation that said, okay, not only is this interesting mathematical physics, but it seems that we needed to describe the universe, really revived the study of relativity and black holes. Since then, what I'm going to call sort of the inverse dark ages, I think perhaps in some sense we've gone a bit too far on the other side. Black holes have become a cornerstone in much of theoretical physics, and in some sense, we almost take them for granted. We take some of these predictions for granted. It's almost like obvious. It makes sense. They have to be out there. It has to be as described by relativity. And I'm speaking from a person that's so far devoted my entire career to studying black holes. So I'm not that critical of it. I love general relativity and black holes. But I think from a scientific perspective, when it's not so much that we're interested in beautiful theories that we love, we want to make sure that these predictions have some kind of connection with reality. And I'd say that as of today, we don't really have the kind of confirmation that general relativity actually is correct in this dynamical strong field regime. And I would say that just if you think about what the prediction of a black hole is, that, okay, at some region in space-time is curved, but it's so curved that space-time is undergoing gravitational collapse to a singularity. I mean, if you've even said in words, it sounds absurd, but that's what general relativity predicts. And so it's an astonishing prediction. We need an astonishing level of evidence. And I think right now that's not, we don't really have that. So let me, before sort of going a little bit back to that, let me actually be a bit more precise about what I mean by the dynamical strong field. Now, it's not easy to actually characterize in relativity because of the covariance of the field equations. The fact that there are no characteristic scales in relativity. So it's not like our other fundamental theories where there's some small length scale above which we might say now interactions are going to be strong with some sort of scale of interactions above which we might differentiate weak from strong dynamics. In relativity, there's no intrinsic scale. And because of the covariance of the theory, you could always choose coordinates where something looks very bad. So this is a little bit vague. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to define the strong field regime as sort of as the regime where the solutions, either in terms of the kinematics or the dynamics, exhibits the most nonlinear, if you will, departures from Newtonian gravity that there are. in particular, if we can choose a coordinate system that's well adapted to that. So in some sense, in the best possible coordinates, where things should be as simple as possible, the solutions are still highly nonlinear. And then the second part of this, the strong field, is there's going to be some dynamical process, and in this regime, the radiative degrees of the freedom of the theory, in other words, gravitational waves, are strongly excited.
Excuse me. About the first point, that there are no characteristic scales, that's true of pure relativity, but as soon as you add matter...
Yes, exactly, yeah. So I'm just thinking just the pure geometry side of the Einstein equations, the left-hand side. And so, of course, now to define this, we're going to have to introduce a scale, and I will do that right now. But actually, in the field equations, there's no object of characteristic scale below or above which you expect different behavior. For example, black hole solutions are arbitrarily large or arbitrarily small. There's no difference in terms of this, of sort of curvature in a microscopic black hole versus an astrophysical black hole. They're the same solution.
Well, some would say that until you get near the singularity, you really don't have a strong gut.
Right, and that's that. But that would apply to small black holes and large black holes as well. So there's no preferred scale until you introduce some other physics, the Planck scale or matter, for instance. Okay, so let's based on what we know, again, so there's no scale, but let's introduce a scale. So let's introduce a mass and a radius, and from the known solutions, the Schwarzschild solution, we expect to reach this strong field if the compaction of the object in terms of m over r essentially approaches 1. So if we have a certain amount of mass within a certain radius, and this ratio is close to 1, then we expect strong field nonlinear dynamics. We expect black holes to form. To try to see when the radiative degrees are strongly excited, we can appeal to the quadrupole formula. So that says that the power, if there's some accelerating matter, the power in gravitational waves is proportional to the third time derivative of the quadrupole moment of the source squared. Just to a simple dimensional analysis, this is the sort of the quadrupole moment of some source. And now if we introduce a time scale over which that source varies t, this is sort of the characteristic power of gravitational waves that will be emitted. And everyone asks, well, how can we make this as large as possible? Well, you want the source to vary on time scales that are essentially the light crossing time of the source. And so if you do that, essentially what you get at the end of the day is that in this regime, the power approaches the Planck luminosity. Now you can say, well, that's not surprising. You could have gotten that just by dimensional analysis to begin with. But the thing that's interesting about this, well, one is usually we think we associate Planck units with quantum effects, but notice that there's no h-bar in this. So that's interesting, that the Planck luminosity is an interesting scale in pure classical relativity. And essentially what this is implying, so we've introduced some scales, we've introduced a certain amount of energy that's varying in a certain rate, in a certain radius. What this sort of suggests, and there are various, I mean, that's a lot of what this talk's going to be about, is one example of this. But it seems in relativity, if you try to produce some kind of a causal process that can have power that's larger than this, even though relativity doesn't have an intrinsic scale, what will happen is you'll either form naked singularities or black holes. So in relativity, there really is, in terms of power, this Planck, that the Planck luminosity does seem to be some kind of a limiting luminosity in some sense. Okay, so this, does a strong field exist in our universe? I'd say at the moment, we definitely know there are regions in the universe where we need this, where if relativity is correct, then the strong field is relevant. So for example, the candidate black holes that we know about, the supermassive black holes in the centers of galaxies, the various stellar mass candidate black holes, neutron stars, the cosmos, there's definitely evidence that there are places in the universe where this is relevant. On the other hand, in terms of testing that this really is as described by general relativity, in other words, do we have observations that are precise enough, not only that we can say, okay, there's a compact source that's of, say, the Schwarzschild radius of a curved black hole, but not only that, but space-time is being warped as quantitatively would be described by relativity. In other words, is it a Kerr solution? Is it more than just a dark compact object? I'd say, as of today, we don't have any evidence for that. And similarly for the radiative aspects of it. So the strongest known source of gravitational radiation, at least if those rumors that LIGO is going to have an announcement next week is correct, as of when they first detected, I think, yeah, that's the latest rumor that I've heard. February 11th is what I've heard is going to be the announcement. But prior to that, the strongest known source of gravitational radiation is this double pulsar, and it's still 27 orders of magnitude away from the Planck luminosity. There are some observations that are started that, in principle, if they become better, could test relativity without gravitational waves. For example, observations of, or inferring the mass-radius relationship of neutron stars from flares of various pulsars. On the other hand, given the uncertainty in the knowledge of the equation of state of neutron stars and other aspects of these observations, they're not yet at a level where they can actually constrain the theory. Likewise, for black holes, there are some, with some of these X-ray binary systems, there are certain binaries which look like neutron star binaries versus black hole star binaries. And it seems that with the black hole cases, it's consistent with there not being a surface. So material is accreting onto a horizon as opposed to a surface. So there's some evidence that these compact objects that look like black holes actually have horizons as well. But again, it's not that the data is not strong enough. Well, there are enough uncertainties in the models that we don't know that it's a Kerr black hole, for instance. I think a lot of, again, this should start changing very, very soon. That's as soon as next week. We will start having evidence, perhaps from LIGO, if the rumors are correct. And likewise, the Event Horizon Telescope is starting to now probe scales that are close to the Schwarzschild radius in the center of our galaxy. And with several years of data, they should be able to get a very concise enough view of the so-called image of the black hole, sorry, the shadow of the black hole, where actually the shape of the shadow does would allow you to test, for instance, is it really a Kerr black hole? I should also to mention that on the scale of the cosmos, if you do this little back of the envelope calculations and say like what's the strong field regime, notice it's got nothing to do with the density necessarily. That's the interesting property of black holes, is that it's not necessarily an equation of density. So for example, if you take an asymptotically fat space and you take matter that's the density of the average density of the universe today, and you start filling up a sphere, when that sphere becomes of order the Hubble radius, then it will collapse to form a black hole. So the universe on scales of the Hubble radius, and this is not just at the Big Bang or a big crunch or whatever, it's any time during the evolution of the universe on scales of the Hubble radius, we're in the strong field regime. So that might also give you pause, well, how convinced are we that relativity in this regime is the correct description of space and time, in particular given the apparent observations of dark energy? And I would say that we don't yet have independent confirmation that relativity is correct on those scales. Okay, can we probe this in the labs? And I guess, as I mentioned, this was sort of what originally got me interested in this, was a suggestion that the LHC could be a black hole factory. It's now almost two decades old, a suggestion. And it's really, it comes from, it's inspired by string theory that there might be extra dimensions. And the argument is actually relatively simple in the sense that, well, they were trying to address the so-called hierarchy problem. Why is gravity so weak if you consider it a force compared to other fundamental forces? And the answer was, well, if there are extra dimensions, at least in principle, gravity doesn't have to be weak at all. It could be as strong as the other fundamental forces. We're just fooled into thinking that it's weak because we don't see them. But if you could actually now get to probe scales that are that small, for example, high-speed particle collisions where you start to probe on small scales, at a sufficiently high energy, those particles will notice the extra dimensions, and then they notice that gravity is actually a lot stronger than what you would naively think if you thought the space-time was four-dimensional. And very soon afterwards, various people, including Steve, realized that if that's the case, then generically the outcome should be black hole formation. As I mentioned, as of today, there's no signs that actually is happening, but who knows, it could be 10 TeV or 100 TeV where the Planck scale starts to be relevant. has just mentioned, so I've sort of motivated, or I've sort of described the strong field of regime as if there's one strong field. I've spoken a lot about astrophysics, the supermassive black holes, stellar-mass black holes. For the rest of the talk, I'm really going to focus on ultra-relativistic collisions. And in a sense, they are both strong field, and as I've defined. On the other hand, there are some, I'm not sure that there is this one single strong field in relativity. In fact, there might be very different regimes of the theory, which both have properties of what I've mentioned as strong field, but the ultra-relativistic case might be very different from the astrophysical case for several reasons. And as I'll sort of say a bit more, one thing that's different in the ultra-relativistic case is that the outcome is at least conjectured to be irrelevant to the structure of the source. So what's producing the curvature shouldn't matter in these ultra-relativistic collisions at arbitrary at large enough velocities. That's definitely not true in sort of the rest mass-dominated regime of relevance to astrophysics. The other thing that's interesting in these ultra-relativistic cases is that you can get this nonlinear dynamics, in other words, black hole formation, starting from arbitrary weak field solutions. So the state before the collision can have as little curvature as you want, and afterwards you could have a black hole. And that's definitely not the case in with a black hole collision, say, in the universe. And there are various other things that suggest that these might be, there might be very different regimes. And I also mentioned sort of at the end, it's also not 100% clear that sort of the infinite boost limit, where sort of these problems were actually first studied by Penrose in the 70s, is the same as the very large but finite boost cases that are relevant to what most of what I'll be saying. It probably is that they are the same limit, but there might even be differences there there as well.
So what kind of differences do you have in mind in that context?
Well, just from the perspective of your answer, what are these solutions? So if you take a large but finite boost solution, there's no gravitational radiation in some sense. You can always go to its rest frame and it will always be static. Whereas once you take the infinite boost limit, there's no longer a rest frame. In some sense, it's all become a gravitational shockwave.
Yeah.
So in that classification, it's sort of very different, the kinds of curvature in some sense. But I mean, so far the indication suggests that the one really is the correct limiting case of the other.
Yeah.
That's probably the case, but no.
I'm just wondering whether there's an idea for what could go wrong with sort of not really smoothness of the limit. Maybe it's not quite smoothness, but at least having a well-defined limit.
Yeah, I mean, I think. I would say that probably they are, that nothing goes wrong. There are actually some results from in mathematical relativity by Luke and Rodniansky, where they looked at spherical colliding shock waves and proved the existence and uniqueness of the solution to some distance to the future of that, sort of showing that, you know, in some sense, the fact that now you're going to a singular limit where you have a delta function in curvature, essentially, isn't really a problem. There's nothing weird that happens when you take that limit. On the other hand, if you do take that limit, you can't go back. You can't then go to a rest frame. So I don't have a very strong. In fact, it's the opposite. I do think that they are probably the same limit, but it hasn't been shown yet. Okay, so. So this part is the really old part that I'm sure a lot of you have seen before, but I'll just for completeness, I'll sort of describe this again. These suggestions that generically black holes could form when you collide two particles together above the Planck scale. I was skeptical of the result, but let me just give you the arguments and sort of explain in sort of why it happens, and then later I'll try to give a bit of a more detailed explanation for what's going on here. So the argument is essentially purely classical, and it's based on Kipthorne's hoop conjecture. Or at least in the simple form is, if you have a certain amount of matter energy, and if you compact it everywhere sort of in a spherical like direction, so you can take a hoop of this radius equal to the Schwarzschild radius of this distribution of energy, And if it encapsulates the energy of the matter completely in any way in which you can rotate the loop, then a black hole would form. So the way that this is applied to the collision of two particles, so imagine, so we're now in, say, the lab frame. We've got these two particles of some amount of rest mass. It could be arbitrarily small. We boost them to very, very large velocities in this lab frame, and we collide them. So in the rest frame, they have a mass m. They have some characteristic size. But now we're going to boost them to some very large gamma factor, so the energy is enhanced by this factor gamma. So the Schwarzschild radius in the lab frame is associated with this energy. So this increases with gamma for some fixed rest mass particles. And the way that sort of the loop conjecture argument is applied is when these two collide, then if the Schwarzschild radius associated with energy is larger than the characteristic size of the objects, then a black hole should form. Where the Planck scale, the actual Planck scale, and if you want to look at, say, collisions at the LHC comes in, if you say the characteristic size of a fundamental particle is its de Broglie wavelength, then you get not only Planck luminosities, you get Planck energies, lengths, etc. So that's where sort of this Planck scale comes in for quantum particles. But this argument is really just classical GR. I mean, incidentally, I should also mention, and this will perhaps also feature a bit later when I sort of try to describe this in a little bit more detail, is that sort of Kip Thorne's, the original hoop conjecture was designed to be applied to a situation where gravitational collapse was already occurring. So you had a situation where a singularity was going to form. So we were already in this nonlinear regime. And he was asking, does a naked singularity form, or is it closed by an event horizon? And so, for example, like the two example, you know, so the two extreme examples that he looked at is, well, spherical collapse, we know a black hole forms. So it's collapsing. At some point, the matter is going to fall through its Schwarzschild radius, and an event horizon is going to appear. But if you have like cylindrical collapse, or sort of long cylindrical distribution of matter, it's going to collapse down to a singularity. But the hoop that corresponds to the total energy is never going to be larger than this, the length of the string. It will be something like this. So the matter is always going to poke out of the hoop. And in those cases, a horizon doesn't form, a naked singularity forms. So he sort of used this as a criterion for distinguishing between naked singularity formation and black hole formation. So here it's a slight misapplication, or perhaps you could say it's an insightful reapplication of the hoop conjecture to a case asking, does a black hole form or not? So it's a conjecture. I mean, but for this to be relevant to, say, for example, the LHC, there are a couple of important things that this conjecture that would have to be relevant to this kind of interaction. One is it has to be completely generic. It cannot depend on the nature of the particles that are colliding. Because, for example, if we really think that, like say in the LHC example, if you're going through the Planck scale, now the real quantum gravity scale, before this happens, it's got to be a super Planck scale collision. There's going to be some quantum gravity interaction, string theory, whatever, that we don't know about. But still, so if we could make a conclusion that's robust, regardless of us not understanding quantum gravity, it's got to be completely generic. It doesn't matter what the local interactions of the particles are. And the second important point is that it has to be an interaction. For example, if you take a single particle and you boost it, you can boost to arbitrary large velocities in practice, such that from a reference frame that's observing this particle, its Schwarzschild radius will always be larger than the size of the particle. But of course, nothing happens. That's just the coordinate transformation. You can always go back to its reference frame. So it's really sort of a generic interaction that's happening between these particles. And the way that it can be generic, regardless of the nature of the source, is if it's a purely gravitational interaction. So it's an interaction between sort of the gravitational energy of these particles that's producing the black hole. I think over the years, I would say all the evidence has been gathered in favor of this conjecture that it actually is correct. I mean, the earliest example, the first person that really studied this was Penrose back in the 70s, and he was looking at this infinite boost limit that Steve was sort of talking about earlier. Essentially, what you do then is you take, so what he looked at was the collision of these Eichelberg-Sexel solutions. So in Eichelberg-Sexel solutions, you take a Schwarzschild black hole and you boost it to infinite gamma. Of course, that would have infinite energy, but then what you do is you, at the same time, you take the rest mass to zero. So the product of the rest mass and the boost is finite. And what that does is at length contracts all the geometry of the black hole onto a plane-fronted gravitational shock wave. So there's Minkowski space on either side. All the curvature is confined to this plane that's now light-like, so it's moving at the speed of light. And what he did was superimpose two of these solutions and found that there was a trapped surface in this space-time. So the causal future to this, to what happens after these two shocks wave collides, is not known in detail, but at least if cosmic censorship holds, a trapped surface forms, then it's an example that black holes would form. Now, sort of in this limit, there have been other results that have been, I measured this one by Luke and Rodniansky. This is not quite the right thing. It's sort of in spherical collisions. And interestingly, in ADS, there's been a lot of work, in particular by Chester and collaborators, that have looked at the equivalent problem in ADS, but now actually looking at situations where they're not exactly shock waves. They've been sort of smeared out over some distance, and they do find that black brains form in this situation. For the case of finite boost collisions, there have been a few works now that have shown that is also true. Now, just in pure classical relativity, asymptotically flat space-times, we take some models for particles, we do this experiment, and we find that there is a threshold that's consistent with the Hoopp conjecture, above which black holes form and below which black holes don't form. So I'll show you first this one. Again, this is old, so apologies to those that have seen this many times. But this is perhaps an interesting case because, again, what sort of spurred me and Matt to look at this was, I won't talk for Matt, but I at least didn't believe this conjecture. Because at least for me, it seemed that you could have certain forms of matter, like boson stars, which are very weakly self-interacting. And at least I don't know of any principle, energy conservation, momentum conservation, etc., which says that at least a possibility is not that in the large gamma limit, they just pass right through each other, especially if the matter is weakly self-interacting. And that's what this bosonic matter does.
In some sense, the case also of non-zero impact parameter, I would say, is additional evidence because you find that, okay, if I have a little impact parameter, I still form a trapped surface, a little bit bigger, still I do, but once I get out to something of order, the Schwarzschild radius of the center of mass energy, and I stop forming a trapped surface. So that also nicely fits and supports this whole story.
Yeah, I agree. So I would say definitely my intuition was obviously wrong, and there were arguments why it should be wrong. I sort of wanted to see it more viscerally, sort of at a finite boost level. Okay, so let me just show you the results from these boson star collisions. So what a boson star is, it's a solution to the coupled Einstein-Klein-Gordon system. So take a massive scalar field, and for simplicity we made it complex, that's not irrelevant, but at least it simplifies things a little bit. But it's essentially a bosonic field that when you include gravity, there are these stable soliton solutions that people call boson stars. And of course there are many, many flavors of these. We just picked one that was small, and we collided them with varying gammas to see what happens. Now, it would be nice to have relatively weakly self-gravitating objects to begin with, such that the limit that the Hoopp conjecture says is very large gammas before this happened, but that's computationally very expensive. So we actually started with boson stars that were quite compact. So these are almost neutron star compact objects. So they actually are strongly self-gravitating. It's not ideal for this, but at least computational limitations sort of forced us to do this. And the Hoopp conjecture would say that above gamma of 11 for these cases, you'd expect the black hole to form. So let me just show you what happens. So first, this is the gamma equals one case. So these are axisymmetric simulations. So this is what I'm plotting here is the magnitude of the field. This is the symmetry axis here. So sort of imagine spinning it around the axis for the distribution. So these sort of Gaussian blobs of scalar field are the boson stars. This is the gamma one case, but again, these are neutron star-like density objects. So they are going to attract each other just purely through gravitation. So this is the gravitational attraction. They accelerate to each other. They collide. They form this larger oscillating boson star. In this case, a black hole doesn't form, but you form one boson star. But then, this is why we decided to use bosons. Of course, we didn't want to use black holes to test this conjecture, because the Heron collision of two black holes should always form a black hole if cosmic censorship holds. But the conjecture is it doesn't really matter what the model particle is. It could be black holes, it could be boson stars, it could be fundamental particles, whatever. And the reason we chose boson stars is previous studies that have looked at boson star collisions in the weak field limit show that these really did behave like classical solitons. In other words, if they'd collide, there'd be some interesting nonlinear interaction, essentially an interference phenomenon, but they'd pass right through each other and reassemble into perfect objects afterwards. It's sort of a classic soliton interaction. So they interact, but in a sense, very weakly. There's nothing about the matter interaction that makes them want to stick. So if the Hoopp conjecture is correct, it will have to be purely the gravitational side. And this you can now start seeing at gamma of 2. So, or another way of thinking is that there's a competition between kinetic energy and the gravitational attraction. The matter is not adding any attraction, and yet then kinetic energy wins. They pass through each other and they explode outwards. The reason that they don't reassemble into the solitons here is that this is not the weak field, that there is a very strong gravitational collapse. But in any case, at this gamma of 2 now, they do pass through each other.
What is the
boson
star's isolation? Is it an exact soliton, or it slowly leaks away?
So it's an exact soliton. Okay. Yeah.
Which means it's a stationary.
Yeah, it's a stable stationary star. Yeah. Okay, but then, to my surprise, and actually even from the Hoopp conjecture at a gamma of 4, we actually found a black hole start to form. And just one comment before I play the animation, we had to change the gauge conditions. Going to these high gammas, the ones that we use for the low gammas don't work. So what you'll see is you can see that now they are length contracted by a factor of 4. As they approach each other, it will look like they spread out. That's a purely gauge effect. There's nothing that's happening before. But the nice thing about that gauge is you can start to see this interference pattern which is the self-interaction of the boson star. So there they go. That's purely gauge. They start to interact, but then a horizon forms around them and swallows up most of the material. Mm-hmm. And there's no quantum mechanics here. There's no evaporation. The horizon actually is increasing in time, but the coordinate volume is decreasing. So that's just a purely coordinate effect. So this now is saying, okay, the Hoopp conjecture, this evidence that in this case, the Hoopp conjecture argument is correct.
I'm sorry, you keep talking about the Hoopp conjecture, but I forget, is that a precise statement, or
order
one coefficient?
It's order one.
Okay.
Right. But okay. So let me explain. I'm going to explain that actually right now. So okay.
I mean, and the density is not uniform. So it could be that the central density was just very high, and you formed a black hole, even though the Hoopp conjecture was based on some overall estimate of the size.
Of the boson size. Right. So if these are very centrally condensed, and so it turns out that these boson stars aren't, and they're basically Gaussian profiles. So they are a bit more centrally condensed, but not enough that you would expect a factor of 3.
But after the collision, they become very centrally condensed.
Yes, and that's sort of getting to the punchline. So what's going on here? Why are black holes being formed here? And what I'm going to try to argue now, and this is somewhat hand-wavy, but then I'll show you some newer results that sort of tend to support that. I think essentially what's happening here is it's gravitational focusing. And so let me explain what I mean by that. So when you take we've got a source of gravity here in its rest frame, you know, it's some, you know, a boson star, a particle, whatever. What happens when you boost that is you don't increase it. You don't increase its curvature in any sense at all. Okay, you give it kinetic energy, but you don't do anything with the curvature. It's just a coordinate transformation. The curvature doesn't change. But what the boost does from the perspective of the lab frame is all of that curvature that the source is producing is being length contracted. So it's being confined to a thinner and thinner volume with higher and higher boosts. And what this layer of curvature, which is what this graphic is supposed to represent, what this does is it acts like a gravitational lens, focusing anything that it passes. And so for example, these are the two highly boosted particles. This is the sort of the curvature associated with them. What happens here, so on the space-time diagram, they're almost traveling at the speed of light. The boost essentially makes it that it's flat space on either side. They essentially don't notice each other until the moment that they collide. And then what happens is one, sort of the elements of one particle experiences the other one essentially as a gravitational lens that focuses to the particles towards the center. And so there are two aspects about this. Well, one which sort of explains this factor of a third. Now, you could argue, okay, this is just dimensional. It's order of magnitude. You shouldn't be expecting the Hoop conjecture to give something that's better than a factor of a third. On the other hand, in these cases, these objects are in some sense outside of the Hoop, and we know that they are compact objects where for neutron stars with various equations of state, they're very, very close to the Schwarzschild radius. So there are examples where there are objects that have compactnesses that aren't very much above that of Schwarzschild, but they don't collapse. So if anything, you'd think that the Hoop conjecture would be wrong on the other side, that it would get to within order unity, but you might need factors of a few larger than the bound that it sets. So for example, not gamma of 4, and not the gamma of 11, but gamma of 30, and then it might have happened. So if anything, you could say that it should have gone the other way. But this focusing, as you said, it actually makes it more compact. So that's perhaps a better diagram. And so what we want to do to test this is we didn't want to use those gamma of the boson star calculations weren't very useful because these are very strongly self-gravitating. In some sense, there's still a lot of rest mass energy in the space-time. So what we want to do is go to a situation where it's mostly kinetic energy. And so what we did is we actually now looked at the collision of what I'm calling fermion stars, but from the classic relativistic perspective, these are just blobs of fluid. So an ideal fluid, there's a rest mass density, there's a pressure, and there's some equation of state, and this is what we usually use to model neutron stars. So I'm calling it a fermion star, just as opposed to the boson star, but it's really a blob of fluid. And I wouldn't want to get into the technical aspects of it, but in some sense, it's easier to model these than at least computationally easier than with the boson star. So we can make a much less compact star. In fact, one which at this compaction, so the Hoop conjecture would say a gamma of essentially 40 would be the threshold, but where we find gamma of 10 leads to black hole formation. And so if this sort of this focusing picture is correct, essentially this is what one way to sort of see what might be going on here is what I'm plotting in this figure here. So what I'll show you next is the actual full numerical solution of the equations with these two fluid blobs. But what I'm showing you here is just the geodesic focusing. So what we've done is we've got these two boosted stars, and I've removed one completely and just replaced it with tracer particles. So coming from the left here, here's the actual boosted star. So this is one that's producing the gravitational lens. That's now going to focus these geodesics. So there's no nonlinear interaction in this picture here. It's just what happens when a set of geodesics get focused by the lens of the other boosted star. And this is with these same parameters, so the gamma of 10. So this is time here, and this is the transverse distance of the geodesic. So you can see here, this is sort of the geodesic facsimile of the star. Here they come. At this moment, they collide, and they get focused. Now the two things that make this the infinite gamma thing, the sort of infinite gamma limit generic, what makes this focusing generic is that when you go to very, very large gammas, again this you length contracting this geometry that does the focusing to a smaller and smaller region. So it starts to act impulsively. And if you have, say, a real object like a star, the only way that it can resist this focusing is if it can build up pressure. But pressure is something that happens on a causal time scale. This is happening instantaneously, so every little fluid element of the star, in some sense, must follow the geodesics of the space-time in the large gamma limit, because it's sort of becoming an impulse of interaction. And so that means that if we now actually did add the other star, it doesn't matter that they're colliding with other elements of the star. The focusing happens on timescales arbitrarily short compared to any other physical process that might try to resist it in the large gamma limit. So the impulsive nature of this gravitational lens sort of would explain the universality. This factor of a few that you get is because of this focusing. And I think this is an important point, going back to the Hoop conjecture. It always seemed to be a bit puzzling that, you know, why can they sort of take this idea of Kipps where gravitational collapse was already happening and apply to this situation? And what this shows is that, so you can't apply the Hoop conjecture to translational motion. What you do need is you do need some sort of collapse to start happening, and that's what this lens does. So from one source perspective, what the lens does is what was mostly translational motion gets converted into radial focusing. And now it's at this point, now that there's still translational motion, but now there's a significant radial flow, and now it makes sense to apply the Hoop conjecture. So it's sort of in this region that you can apply the Hoop conjecture.
It almost sounds like you should form two black holes, because you collide your two stars, and each one gets focused and gets compressed. And so do you ever see two black holes coming out?
Yes, I'll show you. let me show you the results of these simulations. So I said at gamma of 10, we found the threshold. So gamma's above, we form black holes. Gamma of 8 below. But a gamma of 8 is still pretty large. So there is still going to be a lot of focusing. So these are these two fluid stars. You can see their length contracted by a factor of 8. Now, you usually think what would happen, you smash two blobs of fluid together, they're going to explode. I mean, this is going to be a lot of interesting fluid dynamics happening because they exert pressure. They are strongly interacting. And it's not like the bosonic material. But you'll see at this little gamma, sometimes kinetic energy wins. They do pass through each other, but you'll start to see, well, sort of what I've explained, they focus. But in this case, the gamma of 8 lens is not strong enough for them to focus down to a black hole. They focus down to sort of a small radius. And now on this time scale, the pressure starts to build up and it becomes very strong. And when it gets to a small radius, the pressure causes it to explode. Let me sort of play that again. So you can see here they sort of approach each other. They don't scatter off each other. They pass through each other. They focus, but then the pressure builds up and it blows it apart. But now if we go to the gamma of 10, this threshold, you'll see sort of the same thing happens, and it's now like what you were saying. What we find is we find two horizons first, and then they merge to form a bigger horizon. Now, this might be a slicing effect. They don't form sufficiently far apart that we can argue that we couldn't have found a slice where there might always have been a single horizon. And if we wanted to do that, we'd have to go to much, much larger gamma, such that you'd expect that the focusing would take a lot longer for them to focus to smaller black holes. But at least in a hand wavy kind of sense, this is sort of consistent with this picture, that it's really sort of the one object acting as a gravitational lens on the other that's converting translational energy into radial collapse, and then that's what's causing black holes to form. So sort of a geodesic focusing.
That's the apparent horizon.
Yeah, right. That's another caveat. We don't find event horizons in the simulation. These are just, so we find apparent horizons, and we can evolve them for quite a ways to the future, and there's no sign of any naked singularities. So,
well, also in the high energy one, this is sort of the model dependent stuff where you're talking about, basically compressing the material radially.
Yeah.
In the high energy one, that I think the horizon forms before the collision.
In a sense, you can say that sort of the photon that's going to sort of eventually that's going to become part of the apparent horizon. The shape that is trapped in the usual standard coordinates starts to appear before the moment of the collision in some sense.
Certainly with an axial symmetric collision, if I recall properly, before they actually collide with the tracked surface that you can find in the geometry.
Right.
It includes both of the points.
Yeah, so I think that's what I said. This is represented as clearly as I should have. This is kind of a hand-wavy description, rather imprecise of what I think is going on in these collisions. And to really see that you've sort of got two independent to take it back with the trapped surfaces. So in cases so far where people have looked at trapped surfaces versus event horizons, and the event horizon again is also somewhat of a proxy in the sense that you evolve to a certain point and then you look at the causal past of that last slice. So it's not the causal past of an infinity, but it's the causal past of the last slice.
Yeah, but we can focus on trapped surfaces.
Right, and essentially for example, in astrophysical binary mergers or with black strings, for instance, the apparent horizons in the coordinate systems that people use in relativity, they almost indistinguishable. The only times where there's a difference is, for instance, when two black holes collide, there's a moment where the apparent horizons jump, but the event horizon sort of smoothly, except for the cusp joined together. But there's, well, we haven't found examples where there's much of, there's a noticeable disparity between the apparent and the event horizon. So I think in this case, yeah. So again, except for that moment where are they two or are they one, very soon afterwards, the event horizon and the apparent horizons, I think, are going to be very, well, essentially indistinguishable. Okay, by the way, how am I doing on time here? I'm going a bit slowly, but let me just then mention one, so I won't talk about some of the future open questions, but just one, another aspect about this, which is perhaps interesting. So let's take this focusing thing a step further, and now let's look at non-head-on collisions, and let's look at black holes as the source. So I sort of, the way that I sort of describe it is we've got the little, the particles, or the little fluid elements that make up the star, essentially follow geodesics at the moment that they hit this lens, and it's just because they can't do anything other than follow geodesics because there's not enough time for pressure to deviate them, to make them deviate from geodesics. But now if we use black holes as a source, there is no matter. It's purely vacuum solutions. And if we want to say, well, now let's also not make them collide head on so that they're not necessarily going to stick. Let's look at a grazing collision. What happens? Well, is a focusing argument, can we sort of explain what goes on in a situation like this? Or does it have any implications for what goes on in something like this? And essentially, this sort of work by several people that sort of, again, this is also very hand-waving, but sort of supports this picture. So essentially, what happens is the same kind of thing as with the little particle elements of the star, but now you can sort of think, again, in a hand-wavy sense, there's curvature here. This is the black hole, but this is the curvature that's being sourced by this black hole. Now this curvature, when it passes, when it collides, it's going to be focused as well. And sort of in a sense like this. So there's, so it's at the moment of collision, the little curvature elements of this very boosted black hole solution get focused. But one thing with this as a lens, sort of it's strongest when you're right close to the lens, and it gets weaker the further you're away from it. And so if you imagine it, it's sort of a large impact parameter scattering problem. So these black holes, they're just going to get deflected, and at some point they're going to fly away, but now at a different angle. But if you, again, by causality, this sort of this transverse plane that's being sourced by this black hole, if you will, cannot rigidly bend. So this is going to sort of, in some, in this lab frame, instantaneously, it's going to see the lens of the other black hole. But the focusing is going to be stronger the closer that you are to this other black hole. So see how this is focusing. So this little curvature element is going to be bent at a larger angle than this one. And essentially what that does is, that's where gravitational waves are produced. Because if you think afterwards, so these are going to be deflected by different angles, but after the collision, these are still basically boosted black holes. They can only support curvature in a transverse plane orthogonal to the direction of propagation. So that these were bent at different angles, there's nothing, the only thing that can happen is that it can produce gravitational waves. So this is going to produce gravitational waves, and moreover, it's going to produce gravitational waves that's highly beamed in the forward direction, and it's going to share a similar focusing property. So just like the particles that were focused by this other lens, the gravitational waves are going to be focused. And so this is sort of part of what these perturbative calculations by Veneziano and collaborators, and also some of these effective field theory calculations have shown. And incidentally, with these effective field theory calculations, in this ultra-relativistic limit, things simplify significantly. So there's another aspect where it's not only this the geometric notion that it's as simple as focusing, it's also, so the formal techniques, things simplify quite a bit. So what that implies, and this is actually, so some earlier work that we did with Vitor Cardoso, Uli Spurrocker, when we first saw the simulation results, we didn't understand what was going on. So this is now looking at black hole scattering, and actually relatively low gamma, so boosts of 1.5. What I'm showing you here is You have two black holes that are being scattered with some impact parameter. So here's one coming in here. There's another one, exactly the same mass coming in from this angle, but I haven't drawn it to avoid clutter on the finger. Oh, sorry, on the figure. So there's another, if you can imagine this trajectory flipped around from the other black hole. At least one thing that we were trying to answer, sort of this conjecture was, now if we look at black hole scattering or particle scattering, whatever, then black holes are valid particles in this limit where matter doesn't matter. We're going to ask, well, now we've got a lot of kinetic energy in the space-time, gamma, that depends on the gamma factor. Now, if it's a non-head-on collision, well, even in a head-on collision, a lot of gravitational waves are produced, but in a non-head-on collision, also a lot of gravitational waves are produced. And if we tune the impact parameter just right, we can set up what's so-called zoom-whirl dynamics. So it's an unstable configuration, but we set these two black holes to be whirling around each other. That produces a lot of gravitational radiation. And we sort of imagine that in that limit, with enough fine-tuning, we could get a configuration where we convert all the kinetic energy to gravitational waves. So in other words, we could take something, because gamma can be arbitrarily large, we could have a situation where we have an arbitrarily efficient conversion of kinetic energy to gravitational waves. And so that's what we're doing in this case. Okay, it's a low gamma. And to our surprise, first we thought things were wrong, but we only got half as much gravitational radiation as we thought they should be. We said, what's going on? Where did the other half of the energy go? Because these black holes lost a lot of energy. And then we looked at the apparent horizons, and that's what I'm showing you here. So this is the size of the apparent horizon scaled according to the mass of the black hole. And you can see here they're not colliding. They're just orbiting around you. But essentially in one orbit, it almost doubles in size. So, and this is sort of this is showing the irreducible mass of the black hole. So somehow in this interaction, where the half of the missing energy went, this went into the black holes. They somehow absorbed that other half of the energy, which is very surprising, at least if you look at black hole mergers in the universe, so rest mass dominated cases. The black hole, the horizons essentially don't change significantly until merger. They don't absorb much gravitational waves, because if you think, here's this whirling motion, the characteristic size of the gravitational waves is roughly the size of the whirling motion. Even if you sort of distribute all the energy in some sense in that area, the cross-section for absorption is much too small to account for the black hole self-absorbing the energy that they're producing. So what at least this is, I can't prove this, we haven't got an ambiguous measure of gravitational energy in the strong field regime, but it's at least consistent with this picture that I showed, that what's happening is, in this case, because of the large boosts, gravitational waves are being produced, they're being forward beamed, but they're also being focused down. So they're being focused, and of course the black holes are going to also sort of follow in the center of this focus. So just as with the matter geodesics, the gravitational waves are going to be focused towards these black holes. And so that's enhancing their cross-section for self-absorption of the radiation. And so if you think what this implies is, at least theoretically, let's look at, say, an LHC type thing, or say an advanced simulation that can go to super Planck scales, whatever that is. You can take sort of two particles, say protons, of course they're arbitrarily weak fields in their rest frame. You boost them at sufficiently large velocities, and now let's go bazillion times the Planck scale, whatever, pick a number. And if you now tune the trajectories, the impact parameter, these two microscopic particles, they'll scatter off each other, and what will fly away are these two macroscopic black holes. So one of the outcomes, because of this focusing of the scattering process, is two particles with very high gammas, super Planck scale, can produce two black holes that fly apart that have most of the energy that was in the particles. Okay, so since I've been going way too slow, I'm not going to talk about some of the open questions. I'd be happy to speak with you all on a one-on-one basis on some of these, like how it connects to the infinite boost limit, etc. But let me just conclude. Now, so just getting back to how I started with this. So this was sort of theoretical probes of the strong field. This may or may not be related to a strong field in our universe, but perhaps in the question, is this more than just interesting mathematical physics, or does it pertain to nature? I mean, were we right in being as sort of accepting black holes as wholeheartedly as we have in the last 20, 30 years, you know, since the golden age. And I think so one reason why I can sort of perhaps be as critical about our current observations of the strong field is I think we're really on the verge now in the next 100 years of relativity, well, the next few years, where we are going to be able to probe this part of relativity. And if these LIGO rumors are correct, that's already started happening. And then hopefully that's only going to continue in the next few years as LIGO gets more and more sensitive. These very long baseline interferometry images of the shadow of Sagittarius A star in M87 are going to start probing scales smaller than the Schwarzschild radius. They've already confined things to the Schwarzschild radius. And perhaps we might get probes of we might get polarization measurements of the cosmic microwave that will give us something about the universe on a large scale. But I think within a short order, we'll really know whether this is relevant to the universe or not. Thank you for your time, and sorry for perhaps going a little bit slow again on some of these points. And thanks.
So I was wondering how much fine-tuning is required. I mean, you showed the simulation where the black holes come out with twice the mass. And if you sort of fix the initial kinetic energy and vary the impact parameter, is it only a very narrow range of impact parameters where you see this effect? Is it a lot of fine-tuning required, or is it sort of more generic?
Not too much. It's not like critical phenomena where you need 10, 15 decimals to actually see a few of these echoes. In this case, so, for example, in the head-on collision, large gamma, about 15% of the energy is emitted in gravitational waves. So, you want to sort of think about how thick that line is. So, if this is impact parameter, this is zero. Say this is 15% of the energy that's emitted. Then this critical value is on order the total energy of the space, right? So, that characteristic scale. So, the effective hoop radius for that, and it's sort of something like this. So if you, so we'd originally thought this would go up to 100%, but this argument suggests that perhaps the maximum is about 50%, and you're tuning this impact parameter to within perhaps 10% of that critical value, you'll see most of this 50%. So like in that one case that I showed you, it wasn't much fine tuning at all to get to that.
I have just a silly question about practicalities. In a numerical simulation, how do you identify what a black hole is or a singularity is for?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's sort of kind of with what Steve was saying. So we look for apparent horizons for trapped surfaces. So we look for a region where the outgoing null expansion is zero. And so essentially, all outgoing photons are stalled at that point. Now, if cosmic censorship holds, so if all singularities are inside event horizons, then this apparent horizon is also always inside the event horizon. In situations, so there's a lot of dynamics, you can imagine that they might not be the same, but in stationary situations, like before or after, the apparent horizons and event horizons essentially coincide. And in cases where people have sort of tried to find both, they're actually very, very close by. Now, the other side of the question is, okay, well, that's assuming cosmic censorship holds. And the problem with these simulations is, well, if cosmic censorship doesn't hold, so taking one step back, we can simulate singularities. So when we look at, say, a black hole, we get rid of the region containing the singularity by either sort of coordinates, the so-called puncture coordinates, which seal off the space-time at a point. So the singularity gets, we sort of take a region out and shrink it down to a point, so the singularity is outside of the domain, or we actually cut that piece out of the domain in something called excision. And if there are no naked singularities, that will be consistent, and we'll be able to get a solution without problems, so the code won't crash. If there were naked singularities, we wouldn't be able to do that, and something would go wrong. So So in some sense, what we do is we, if cosmic censorship is satisfied, we'll be able to converge to a solution to the field equations without problem, and that's what happens. If there was a situation where a naked singularity formed, then we'd have to do something completely different. But we'd see something, would say the curvature would start to diverge. We won't find any horizons around them. The code would crash. And perhaps one way to then conclude if it's a naked singularity, because the problem with naked singularity is we don't know what happens to the future of it. The field equations don't tell us. It breaks down. We'd need a theory of quantum gravity. But then what we could do is say that evolve up to a large curvature and excise the causal future of that. And if the causal future reaches infinity or a large distance, then that is a naked large curvature. And then we could converge to larger and larger curvatures and show that it's a naked singularity. But yeah, in the case that I've shown, we have, at least in these cases, we've never seen naked singularities for these collisions.
Other questions? Okay, if not, let's have the speaker here.